Good morning. My name is Kathleen Oldfather, and I've been a member at this fellowship for over 30 years. We welcome all with a warm heart and open mind. Whoever you are and whoever you love, you are welcome here. If this is your first time, a very special welcome to you, and kudos for trying something new. We invite you to sign the guest book out in the narthex area. We have no religious creed here. We believe in the liberal ideal that each person finds his, her, or her own path, whether it's working towards inner peace, social justice goals, or other religious destinations. We invite everyone to stay after for coffee and conversation down the hall in the LSAP room. And please take a look at your bulletin for announcements today. A couple of things to note. There's been an ad running for the Bacon Craft Sale, and now we have a date to put on that, December 9th. Doesn't say that in there, but it's December 9th. And this is one of the few fundraisers that we do during the year. Everyone's invited to participate in whatever way you might want to. By baking or making things or buying things or just enjoying it. It's a fun day. John Alou is offering a path to membership today, pathway class, starting at 12:15 to 1:45, I believe. It's a little longer, new format. There'll be some lunch provided. So if you're interested in membership, talk to John Alou. And there's an announcement in there about circle dinners, and I would encourage you to read that and sign up for those. And Madalena, back here, she's helping with the sign-up. So, okay, I've got some helpers for the chalice lighting. We light this chalice to honor the memory of those who have come before us, kindling flames of wisdom in dark times, willing to challenge orthodoxy even at great personal risk, giving us a legacy of freedom and a love of truth, a legacy that warms our hearts and lights our paths. So please stand as you're able and join me in singing All Our Architects. Number 288. I'd like to invite all the young people to come up to the front. And special invite. Good morning. It's so nice to have Judy here. That's what it says in the bulletin. Does that look like Judy Cattell? Have you ever heard the word understudy? Well, Judy's husband, Dick Cattell, had to go to the hospital, not feeling well. And so Bryce was nice enough to be the understudy, which if you were in New York City and had a Broadway show, they'd have a star. And if you don't know what the understudy, it's a person that's prepared to go on instead if the star is sick. So Bryce is our understudy. And we're talking this month, or we're thinking about memory a lot. And so I'm going to ask Bryce, and maybe you'll ask Bryce, some questions about memory, things that he remembers from his life. Is your mic working, Bryce?
Yes, it is. I think so.
Okay.
Sound like it?
And everybody here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I am Bryce Hobrock, better known as Shirley's husband, her aide and aide-de-camp assistant, etc. And I am 81 years old, believe it or not. I don't believe it, even though my body tells me I am 81. My mind tells me I am just a recent high school graduate. So if you're lucky, why, you'll live your life and you will remember what it was like to be your age, because I do remember what it was like to be your age.
What is your earliest memory?
Well, I remember many things, most of them beginning about 3 years old. And the thing that characterizes them is that there was some event, something outstanding about a particular memory that causes me to remember it. Some, mostly all bad things, things that really, and I'm not going to tell you the worst ones, but I'll tell you some that there's a reason why I remember them, if you'd like, and we'll save the others for later. I want to mention first that, in fact, I have written down my memories. I forgot to bring a copy today to prove that I did. 475 pages of things I remember about my life from the earliest memories up to the present. So maybe another time we can discuss that. Do you want me to...
Well, I'll ask you a question.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite memory about your mother or your father that you might be willing to share?
Well, nothing favorite, I suppose, other than they were always there, and they were always there to tell us when we were doing the wrong thing, for that example. Even when it came time to tell us about what roosters and chickens do, why, they were there to explain all of that. but my parents were, and particularly my mother, were ready at all times to go out to the yard and cut a switch from a bush and to reinforce whatever was being said. They weren't cruel or anything. It's just when I was sassy and said, no, I'm not going to do that, well, there was always a threat of that. So I guess that's a memory.
Well, I know the answer, but I'm going to ask you, do you or did you have any brothers or sisters? And do you have a particularly good or bad memory about something happening with a sibling?
Well, I had one brother, 2 years older, and like all older brothers, they're all bossy and always trying to keep you down. But I grew up strong, and it wasn't long before we were having physical fights. And it was quite a while, though, probably a teenager before I could take him. But we were very different from one another. I was very bookish, a reader, and he was very much an active person into farming and hunting and all of that. But so much of what I did, I had to copy what he did. He loved horses, and so therefore I had to have a horse too, much to my undoing.
Okay, I have more questions, but if any of you want to come and ask a question, feel free to crawl over here, okay? Do you remember the house you grew up in? And did you have your own room?
I remember the house where I was born and lived until age six. It had one bedroom, And we had no running water or electricity or indoor bathroom. And the entire family slept in one bedroom. And my brother and I, after we were out of the crib, had a small bed. And he slept one direction and I slept the other so that we'd fit in the bed.
That's great. What activities did you like to do as a kid or as a teenager?
Well, playing with cousins was always a favorite activity. My toys, their toys, of which there were very few. But we all grew up in the country, and we had farms filled with animals of all types. And those animals and places were very fertile places to go and do things, climbing into the hay mow of the barn and trying to catch pigeons. The babies in their nests and things of that sort. So there was no shortage of anything to do. There was no TV, of course, no telephones, no nothing, except you were left to your own devices to figure out what you were going to do. Yes.
Can you come over so we can say your name?
Oh, my name's Carrie. What was your school life like? Or do you remember it?
Well, I came from a family of school teachers, and I had an aunt who was my first grade teacher and had been a teacher in the local public school and taught 40 years in the public schools of Kansas, and there are others. My grandmother wanted to be a school teacher, but she couldn't because there was no money to send her for training. So she asked that all of her seven children, living children, become school teachers, and they all did for the most part. So I was raised with school from the very beginning, at home, connections with those school teacher aunts, and going to the classroom and sitting in even before I was of school age. So I grew up favoring school, and which I still do today.
My name is Arthur. How much pigeons did you chase?
Well, the barns were full of pigeons. Arthur asked, how many pigeons did you chase? The barns were full of pigeons, and they flew in and out at will, and they all raised their babies in there, and the babies grew up and fell out of the nests. Why, we all were glad to pick them up, and I don't remember. We certainly didn't eat pigeon, but we probably just put them back in their nests.
Okay, what memories make you happy or comfort you today?
Well, I suppose just thinking about the family activities that occurred in the first 18 years of my life, the abundance of relatives and community that was available to us through school or church or just the family. The family dinners that occurred at every holiday, the good food, actual work activities it actually involved communal sharing of work, either at our own house when you had a big job to do, building or harvesting or something like that, the whole community came in to assist, and then your mother and everyone else available cooked these enormous meals that were so good. And that's why I love pie today, is that there was always pie. So I think just there was so much going on all the time. We were never bored. When my daughter got to these same ages, her main comment was, I'm always bored. There's nothing to do. And I said, I don't know that word. I don't know what it means.
Any kids have another question? Well, I had another. Are there things you can't remember now that you wish you could?
No, I'm selective in what I choose to dwell on. And bad things I tend to choose to forget. Good things I have documented, and I'm still thinking about them, and occasionally I will think of other things that I haven't documented, but they're probably not anything I will write down at this stage.
All right. Well, what do you say? Can we thank Bryce? Thank you, Bryce.
You're welcome. Anytime you have a question, why, you just ask me. What was it like back in the 1940s and 50s when you had no electricity, no TV, no running water? How did you live? You ought to think about how fortunate you are in your very good lives today to have all of those conveniences.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're
welcome. Thanks for being the understudy.
You're welcome.
When you get to convene, you often run across someone you've never heard of while researching or thinking about it. And in the last week or so, I ran across a name. His name is Parker Palmer, and I really enjoyed some things he wrote about memory. Parker Palmer is an author, educator, and activist who focuses on issues in education, community leadership, spiritual and social change. He's the founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal. He shared a couple stories about memory. For the record, he is 79. And when he introduced these stories, he wrote that the older folks will understand why I love this story. Younger folks can hear it as a preview of coming attractions. A man about my age was walking down the street when he saw another man approaching. As they got face to face, the first man said, "I'm sorry, I know we've met, but for the life of me, I can't remember your name." The second man looked at his shoes for a moment, then looked up and said, "How soon do you need to know?" And Palmer goes on to share that at least once a day, I go upstairs to get something, only to forget what I'm after by the time I get there. So I go back down, hoping to rekindle the memory by returning to the site of the original inspiration. Then I realize I can't even remember where I was when I embarked on this ill-fated adventure. Some will recognize that as something happening more and more. Palmer admits that certain kinds of memory loss are no laughing matter. And I know what he means by that. As many of you know, my mother died about 18 months ago after suffering from Alzheimer's disease for many years. And my brother Jack, who's only 57, already has severe Alzheimer's disease. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about memory and thinking about who are we when we no longer can remember anything. I spent over 5 years visiting my mom at Meadowlark, pretty much every other day. She could remember almost nothing, as far as I could tell. Once, early in that time, I showed her a photo from her wedding day with herself and my dad and their parents. And she pointed to my dad and she said, "Oh, I like him." Just with the spark of a girl with a new crush. And I was so thrilled, and I framed the photo and put it in her room. But she never again recognized any of them when I was there to ask her about it. After a while, I stopped asking her questions about the past. It seemed kind of cruel. We spent our time looking at the trees, and I talked about how windy it was, maybe, and the flowers. And we jabbered about the birds, and we listened to music. And we drank coffee together. Mostly, I just sat with her and held her hand and gave her hugs. And I concluded that that's really what she needed and enjoyed the most. People often ask me if she knew me, and I think she knew I was someone important in her life. We were lucky that she retained her basic good nature and generally happy way of being. But she needed love, and she gave love back. And my love for her never diminished with her cognitive decline. I could and I can remember what a wonderful person she was, and that helps keep me whole. My mother's sister had the same condition. So did her mother and her aunt and her grandmother. So my four other siblings and I are often wondering which one of us will get it. Will we all get this? Who's doing the most physically or mentally to ward this off? You know, will playing bridge or playing a musical instrument help? Will riding a bike 50 miles in the mountains? Or how about running a marathon? One brother is taking the 25andMe DNA test to learn if he carries the genes, because he wants to make decisions about Social Security based on whether he thinks he's going to get Alzheimer's disease. Now, I think that's kind of funny, but that's kind of how your mind works when you're doing this. Many of my friends and family are worried about the loss of memory, their own and their loved ones. It will happen to most of us at some time, to some degree. It's a normal part of aging. Those of us lucky enough to live a long life will get to enjoy a few memory glitches, as Parker Palmer calls them. We will still be the person who is loved by family and friends. I think the best plan is just to live each day as fully as possible, trying to make some differences in this world and finding joy in it all. Parker Palmer encourages us to keep some perspective about it and a sense of humor, as you could tell from his stories. And here's a poem, which he included in his bit, by Billy Collins. It speaks to the humor and the poignancy of memory loss. And it's called Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go. Then obediently, by the title, The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. As if one by one the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps? The address of an uncle? A capital of Paraguay? Whatever it is you're struggling to remember, it's not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall. Well, on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart. Going to move to the, okay. Let us remember those today who came before us and founded this fellowship 60 years ago. Let us remember those who nurtured it along since then. When I look around this room, I remember faces and hear voices that used to be here that helped nurture this. If you're proud of this fellowship, become its advocate. If you're concerned for its future, share its message. If its values resonate deep within you, give it a measure of your devotion. This fellowship cannot survive without your faith, your confidence, your enthusiasm. Its destiny, the larger hope, rests in your hands. We will now receive the gift of your offering.
Thank you, Renee. We come with joys in our hearts, with sorrows in our hearts, with all kinds of emotions. This week, I would like to thank the other folks from UU who joined us at the Jewish synagogue on Friday night. We had, I know, more than a dozen UUs, and there were over 100 people there supporting the Jewish congregation in the wake of the shootings in Pittsburgh. And it's important that we continue to come together and support one another. That's important always. And part of our support for one another is in the personal. Sabrina Boker reports that she was in the hospital for a week and she's better now. So we're really happy to have her back with us. As Kathleen said, Dick Cattell is also in the hospital. He has pneumonia, and I visited with them yesterday. And he's tired, but they're hoping that he'll be discharged early in the week. Larry Weaver reports that a good man is dying today. Frank Aluso, the Manhattan High soccer coach, is in the hospital with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Please keep him and his family and the families of the players in your thoughts. And apparently something's going to happen this week on Tuesday. Fred Reynolds reminds us to vote if you have not already voted. If you have already voted, don't. But every vote does count, and some races will be very close. Roger Johnson says that 218 years ago, John Adams became the first president to live in the White House. At that occasion, he said, "May none but Ah, may none but honest and wise men rule under this roof. Well, may none but the honest and wise rule under that roof. Well, yes. Okay, no more comment on that. We have a couple of joys. Michael Oldfather says, hurrah for the change to daylight wasting time. Organized for increasing it to 9 months. Dixie Moreau's joy is that she's back from Winnemucca, Nevada, where she had a wonderful visit with her daughter and family. And Les Lotchke's joy is that their friend Jory is with us here today from New Jersey. Welcome. Her 2-year-old son and husband are back at their house, so thank you for venturing out and joining them, and thanks for sharing her with us. All of these things that lay on our hearts, that lay on our minds, we bring with us, and we offer our support to one another. We also keep in mind that there are many joys and concerns that remain unspoken and that are in our hearts, and we extend to everyone whatever support they need. Ask if you need something. We're here for you. Our hymn is number 336, All My Memories of Love. Recently read an essay called Time to Cull My Library. I could identify. When we moved here from Oklahoma City, I knew I'd have less room and I couldn't keep all my books. But how do you get rid of books? They're all the reasonable reasons to hold on to them, like I might need them for something in a sermon, or I haven't read it yet, or I love that book. I know I'll read it again. But Martin Copenhaver, the theological school president who wrote the essay, noted that many of the books he couldn't let go of, it wasn't because he was going to read them. He cites the books my father gave me from his own library. I can relate to that. I still have a bunch of those, too. And one, he said, a girlfriend had given him, a woman who has long since committed suicide. He says, I cannot bear to give that book away. He keeps books that were old friends and ones that evoke a certain time in his life. Opening those volumes, he says, taking in the dusty smell that emerges is a sure way to be transported back to that time in my life. Some books he kept as trophies, signs of a victory over dense academic language and ideas. It seems that at least for Copenhaver, and I have some sympathy for him, books are about a lot more than reading. They're about memories. I suspect a lot of the things we own and can't let go of are about memories. The crystal handed down by your grandmother. The worn sweater you hold on to, though it's no longer wearable, because it reminds you of sitting by the fire so many chilly nights. The silly trinket you bought on your honeymoon, your child's self-portrait in crayon. Memory serves as the marker of our lives. The songs drummed into our auditory cortex, the skills like knitting and bicycling, procedural memories that once learned seem to stick, and of course the elaborate stories and connections that make up who we are. Science writer Rebecca Rupp claims our accumulated memories are personal reservoirs of triumphs and tribulations, joys and sorrows, loves and hatreds, and experiences, real and imagined, coalesce to form our personhood and stretch across the years to give us what Nobel laureate John Eccles called continuity of self. We assemble ourselves piece by piece from recollections. We are what we remember. I have a friend, Sky, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 66. Did you know that it's Alzheimer's Awareness Month? It is. It's Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Anyway, Sky writes a blog, and I'd like to share part of one of his posts about he and his friend with the same diagnosis. He writes, "We've been overwhelmed by the losses that we imagined ahead of us. A certain grimness was beginning to feel normal. We both worried about the changes ahead in our identities, literally who we are, while the incurable disease runs its course. As the attacks on our intellects and memory continue, we feared changing into people neither we nor our loved ones would value spending time with. How can we not become strangers? What is left for us if the glue of memory no longer holds ourselves together?" Sky seems to accept what Rebecca Rupp has written, that we assemble ourselves from recollections. We are what we remember. Remembering has power deeper than we might sometimes realize. Have you ever been transported back to a place and time by a smell? The Presbyterian womanist theologian Katie Cannon has written, "Our bodies are the texts that carry the memories, and therefore remembering is no less than reincarnation." So it's almost as if the memories don't only live in our brains, they live in our bodies. And she's not talking just about those muscle memories, those the way that our bodies know how to drive or how to knit without even thinking. Those memories that are not the procedural, the how-tos that fade much more slowly and that we have trouble even articulating. Ask me how I know something in muscle memory, and I can't tell you how I know that. I just do. I can only show you. While practice makes perfect for those kind of memories, procedural memories, doing memories, the recollections, the stories that we assemble ourselves from are quite different from that. These we can and do articulate. We tell them, and they live in us, in our senses, in our minds. Our bodies are the texts that carry the memories. On the other hand, those memories, those building blocks of our lives, those recollections that make us who we are inconsistent and unreliable. Have you ever gotten into an argument about an event where two of you were present and remember a whole different set of things happening? Yes, memory is not to be trusted.
Memories vary wildly in their power. Some don't have the staying power of others. And perhaps we never fully committed it to long-term memory, or it may be that they faded with time or with disuse, or that with more information crammed into our brains, they're harder to find. I've often said that if I could free up a tremendous amount of brain space if I could divest myself of 1970s song lyrics. Memories may be dependent on cues. You may not be able to remember something because your mood doesn't match the mood in which you learned it. We especially forget things that don't have meaning for us. Lists of random words, for example, or those dates you memorized for some long-ago history class. The more information and associations we have with something, the more likely we are to remember it. The more we go back to it and rehearse it, the more likely we are to remember it. On the other hand, there are things that we do over and over again, and that makes all the memories of that particular thing blur together. So we can't distinguish the separate occasions. Repeated episodes run into one another. And that leaves fewer things to stand out for us to assemble our recollections from. Can you remember the first time you were on an airplane? I do. I was like 4 or 5 years old, but I remember it really well. Now, the 14th time I was on an airplane, I have no concept. First, stand out. And then, if you're old enough, do you remember where you were and what you were doing on September 11th, 2001? I bet you do. Do you remember where you were and what you were doing on September 10th, 2001? No. Oh, Roger does. Okay. One person does. Yes. Okay. Roger, most of us don't. Strong feelings, positive or negative, strengthen our memories. And it seems that if there's a lot of adrenaline going, our memories become more detailed and often more accurate. Unless it's so traumatic that we break down, then we might have only fragmented memories. In the wake of the Kavanaugh hearings, Dr. Ford was mocked for not remembering important details, but the fragments of memory, she reported, is how traumatic memory often works. With trauma, we may even block the memory completely. Our memories then are all selective, favoring intense moments and releasing the humdrum. Science has also taught us that our memories are not static. They do not store in our brains unchanged. When we bring out a memory, we generally rewrite it. Sometimes we even rewrite memories that we didn't even have. My brother liked to tell the story that he said he remembered about when the neighbor toddler next door drank Clorox. Until the day my mother said, "That happened months before you were born." "Well," said my brother, "I remember rushing to the hospital in the womb. I was under the steering wheel." So, most of the time, change our memories as we hear other people's versions of the story, or as we change how we see ourselves. We rewrite our memories. I heard the example of a woman who learned from a detective that her husband had been cheating on her, and in a moment, she rewrote years of her life. Pieces that hadn't made sense suddenly fell into place, and there was no going back to a previous understanding. The memories were rewritten. Our memories can change so radically that research has demonstrated that eyewitness testimony, remembering what you have seen, is notoriously inaccurate. Researchers have been able to implant memories, that is, to convince people that something happened to them that didn't. repressed memories come tumbling out later, and they may be strong and they may be completely accurate, and sometimes they may not be as accurate. We seem to have memories that are completely unconscious that nevertheless may pop up as intuition or hunches. In short, there's a lot going on with our memories that we don't seem to have much control over, and frankly, that make memory seem pretty untrustworthy. Memory, says journalist Alexander Chase, is the thing you forget with. And so it seems some days. Now, as we age, we learn tricks to bypass our failing memories. They don't always work, though. There's the story of the London Philharmonic Orchestra's conductor, Sir Thomas Beecham, from the early 20th century. Running into a woman he recognized but whom he could not place, he recalled that she had a brother. So he's hoping to get hints to help him navigate the conversation. So he asked, "And how is your brother? Is he still in the same line of work?" "Oh, he's very well," responded the woman. "And still king." Memory may be particularly tough when someone finds themselves losing it. I return to Sky's blog. Isolation and loneliness may come to star in the time we have left as our social selves deteriorate. We might lose our lifelong interest in learning new things, appreciating clever songs or jokes. Our lives will continue their inevitable decline into a disastrous train wreck. This is a nightmarish list of disastrous outcomes, and it's only just a generic beginning. I'll bet that each of the millions of people living with a dementia can add nightmares of their own as they contemplate their futures. Yet a deeper look reveals many of our shared nightmares to be possibilities, not carved in stone inevitabilities. Ironically, I can still vividly remember the times more than a year or so ago now when I could not get through a day without tears. Those tears in reaction to his diagnosis. Every day, I was involuntarily visited by my loss list with unhappy results. So perhaps better understanding what memory is and how it works could help in managing it. Memory, writes psychologist Peter Russell, is not like a container that gradually fills up. It's more like a tree growing hooks onto which memories are hung. We tend to set our memories into stories, giving them beginnings and middles and ends. We organize them. There's a study, the Grant study of Harvard men. Researchers followed them for 50 years, beginning in the 1940s. Nearly all of those guys, of course, ended up serving in World War II. And right after the war, the researchers interviewed them, and then again in 1989 and 1990. And most of the men told far different stories 50 years apart, stories that were tamer and not as horrible as immediately after the war. Except, and this is a crucial exception, except for those who developed PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, they told exactly the same stories. Exact same stories. All the horror intact. Trauma is tricky, though, because the other thing that can happen with it is dissociation, so that nothing about the trauma is remembered, or that it's remembered in fragments, or as something that happened to someone else. Charlotte Delbo, a Holocaust survivor, described it this way: the self who was in the camp isn't me, isn't the person who's here opposite you. No, it's too unbelievable. And everything that happened to this other self, the one from Auschwitz, doesn't touch me now, me, doesn't concern me. So distinct are deep memory and common memory. Without this split, I wouldn't have been able to come back to life. Memory's malleability may make it less reliable. It may also allow us to survive. since we can and do remake our memories. Perhaps we can choose what we wish to remember, as Bryce was saying, and also how we wish to remember it. I don't mean tricking ourselves about details or facts, lying to ourselves. Rather, we can re-examine what we thought happened and come to a better understanding of it. We tend to sow our memories with blame and judgment, casting ourselves as victim or hero or survivor, whatever suits our narratives of ourselves. What if we let go of that need and instead tried to rework our memories in a way that makes us and others happier? If we are what we remember, how do we remember as our best selves rather than as our judgmental, self-centered selves? And if we practice that remembering in that way, can we actually become better selves? Now, you might think that's impossible, but many religious and spiritual traditions suggest that the way we see and interpret life has at least as much to do with our happiness as what actually happens to us. Once more from my friend Sky. One day, I dimly began to realize that the disintegration Sarah and I feared so much was still in the future. Perhaps far in the future, perhaps not to happen at all. A blessing and curse of the Alzheimer's path is its slow speed, at least for me. For many of us on the dementia continuum, especially those with younger onset, we have way more than enough time to consider where the path might lead us. Letting the vocabulary shift from will to might is a huge step. Who says that Sarah or I will die because we've forgotten how to chew or swallow or breathe, or that we will wind up living only in shadow shells of our true selves? Sure, that could happen, but so could a horrendous traffic accident on the way to the neurologist appointment next month. Sky reframed what was going on for him in the future and therefore what was going on for him in the present. And we can do the same thing with our memories. The ancient Taoist, Zhuangzi, wrote this. If someone is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with their own skiff, even a bad-tempered person will not become very angry. But if they see a person in the boat, they will shout at them to steer clear. And if the shout is not heard, they will shout again and again and begin cursing. And all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat is empty, they would not be shouting and not angry. If you can empty your own boat crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you. No one will seek to harm you. Now, neither of these examples, the one from Sky or the one from Zhuangzi, exactly address memory. Rather, they're about how we see a situation. They give us a hint as to how we can deliberately rewrite experiences we've had. Imagine being the person in Zhuangzi's boat, and the other boat came at you and rammed you. You're justifiably angry, especially since you shouted and cursed at the person to steer away from you. Yet there's no need to hold on to anger and unpleasantness. If the other boat had been empty, you wouldn't be angry in the same way. You don't know what was going on with that skipper. Maybe they were deaf. Maybe they were drunk. Maybe they were distracted. Maybe they don't know how to steer a boat. Maybe they were suicidal. There could be a million different explanations. The truth is, the damage is no worse than if there had been no person in the boat at all. Zhuangzi ends this snippet by telling us that for the perfect person, the boat is always empty. They judge no one. Now that may be too lofty an ambition. But we know that we can be more at peace if we can reduce the ways in which we judge and resent others and the ways in which we judge or resent ourselves. How, though, can we do that? Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist and a Buddhist practitioner who wrote a book called Buddha's Brain, which I highly recommend. He offers steps to reassess our past experience and rework it so that it is not as disturbing to us. And here are a few of his steps. Cultivate positive emotions. Bring compassion to yourself. Regard ill will as an affliction. Accept your wound. Meet mistreatment with loving kindness. Now, none of these are easy, but I want to hone in on this next one. Be careful about attributing intentions. And I want to spend some time with this one because it may be the place we can get the most mileage from dealing with our past memories. Hansen even offers us a meditation to help. And I invite you to join now with me in this meditation. Relax and steady the mind, focusing on the breath. Let your body relax into your chair and breathe deeply. Bring to mind a situation in which you feel someone has wronged you. It may be recent, it may be long ago. Be mindful of your reactions to this person, especially the deeper ones. Scan yourself and notice any ill will. Now, reflect on some of the various causes, the 10,000 things that have led this person to act in the way that they have. Consider biologically based factors affecting them, like pain, age, innate temperament, or intelligence. Consider the realities of their life, race, gender, class, job, responsibilities. Daily stresses. Consider whatever you know, or can guess about their childhood. Consider major events in their life as an adult. Consider their mental processes. Their personality. Their values. Their fears. Their hot buttons. Their hopes and dreams. Consider their parents in light of whatever you know or can reasonably guess about them. Consider, too, the factors that may have shaped their lives. Reflect on the historical events and other upstream forces that have formed the river of causes flowing through their life. Look inside yourself again. Do you feel any differently about this person who has wronged you? Do you feel any differently about yourself? We have many choices about things in our lives. We do not have choices about what has already happened to us. We do have choices about how we will think about what has happened, how we will shape and form those memories into who we are. We can choose to form our memories in ways that will grow us into our best selves or our worst selves. We have choices individually. I hoped to also address more this morning about the choices we have as a people about our collective memories, which we call our history. That, though, we'll have to wait for another day. In the meantime, may your memories bring happiness more than they bring pain, and may they grow you into the best self that you can be. Our hymn is number 354, We Laugh, We Cry, and perhaps we can have some of our musical helpers stand up front to lead. We Laugh, We Cry. I invite you to rise in body or spirit. remember that we never walk out into this world alone. We stand on the shoulders of brave and generous ones who have gone before. We walk beside companions who are ready to catch us when we fall. We hold memories of dear ones in our hearts who keep us connected. May we make this our most important work, to remember that who we are does not end at the edges of our own skin.